Next up, we've got This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell here with Evan Brown and John Furrier. We're going to talk about reselling ebooks, privacy on the go, taking companies private, data security, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, recorded February 8, 2013, episode 197. Dude, you're losing your stock. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TWIL to receive $10 off at checkout. And by ShareFile by Citrix. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWIL. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. I'm here with my co-host Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday. Hope everything's going well with you.
Happy Friday to you. Great to see you. Great to be able to speak to you in a voice that is neither hurting me nor anyone listening in, hopefully.
Well, yes, you're sounding just fine. Glad you appear to be feeling better as well.
Yes, even more important. This cold that's going around is not fun, folks. Keep yourself on the echinacea and the emergency and don't get it because it hits you with just about everything out there. Also joining us from Palo Alto, California and SiliconANGLE is John Furrier. Hello, John.
Hello, Denise. Thank you for having me on the show. It's fantastic to be here and an honor.
It's great to see you again. Hopefully you've been healthy lately.
Yes, I'm the one in my family that's actually been healthy. I've only had a little bit of the cold. We've had a sick person in our household. I have four kids. People might not know that, but all four of them have been sick, three at one time just this week, and one has been sick since 2 weeks before Christmas. And I have a daughter who has mono, who's been out of school for 3 weeks. So, I'm actually meeting with the school today to actually talk about how to keep her in her grade level, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Yes, we wish you all the best with that, of course, and yes, my little week-long cold seems like something quite trivial by comparison. I'm just glad it's over with, though. Let's jump right in and talk about some of the great stuff that's been happening in the world of technology and law this week. As usual, there's a lot going on. Why don't we start out with some privacy stories? So this is pretty interesting and something that you might not have heard of if you don't live in the state of California, and that is that the California Attorney General, Kamala Harris, has issued some guidelines, sort of taking a page from, yes, we have laws on the book, but we want to give you some best practices, too, that go even further than the laws. For mobile app developers, they've called it Privacy on the Go. It's a 22-page report that is a bunch of advice for mobile app developers that, aside from everyone needing to have a privacy policy, which has been the law in California for a bit now, also urges people to take some privacy by design type steps, build them into their mobile apps, such as screens that will pop up and advise people right when they're about to do an authorization or enter information that could be shared in a way that they haven't anticipated. So I really like that this is out there and want to get the word out. California tends to be this place that sets the benchmark for privacy standards. And since mobile has been so wide open on that front, it's nice to see the Attorney General being proactive and trying to take that kind of approach with the industry rather than constantly coming in after the fact and saying, hey, you guys have done something wrong, trying to cut things off before it gets to that point. John, I imagine that both covering the technology industry for SiliconANGLE and just the fact that you know so many people and are so connected into the industry, that you know a bunch of mobile app developers. Is this something that's on their radar?
Not really. I mean, I think the mobile app developers look at it kind of downstream. It's kind of one of those scale problems that happens on the business side. It's kind of the business model problem. But I think now when people see their data, they're seeing like the Path thing happen, where Path just settled something. You probably know more about that, but it was the action that was against Path. So they realize that the data issues are big into the design side. So they're going that way on the front end. But right now the challenges are technical, like how to handle unstructured data is really the biggest issue. So that's one thing. Once they get that under control, I think the privacy policies will be easier managed. So in the trenches of developers, the core issue is how do you bridge big data and DevOps kind of issues, meaning, you know, data is part of the development process, not a secondary effect. So I think we're seeing the first generation of developers look at data not as things that are part of the application, but actually inherently native in how they design software.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach to take, and consistent with what the Attorney General in California would like to see happen. Evan, given that this report doesn't really have the force of law, how do you ballpark it as far as effectiveness goes?
Well, it's important, and it represents, or it's a signpost for the real sea change that we've seen in the last few years. And just to tack on to what John said, you know, boy, is that true. Data really is the important thing here, not just an afterthought as to, you know, the substance of what the technological platform is going to do. And there are a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one is, I guess probably the biggest one is that so much more information is available through to the platform about the end user, about the consumer through the use of mobile devices, because there's so much that we can do through our mobile computing platforms. And then there's information that we don't even know that is available to the platform provider, geolocation data, for example. And it really is that data, that information that drives the ecosystem, and as much as it relies on advertising, particularly third-party advertising within these mobile applications and mobile platforms. So what we see here is an action on the part of the California Attorney General, and we also have seen recent things from the FTC in a couple of different ways, both with more attention to COPPA and also with some similar guidelines like this just released last week. The way that we do computing there's this fundamental new, I'm looking at it at a very general, broad level here, there's this fundamental new way of accessing, using data, communicating with one another in the mobile space. And these actions on the part of the government are very indicative of the importance that is placed on that, and the ways that and it brings to light that we haven't thought about these things in the way we should have, perhaps over the last 10, 15 years.
Right. And John, you brought up Path. I think that that's a really great example of how, you know, you're trying to be fast and come out with a great, wonderfully designed product. I've been on Path for a while now, and it's always fun to use because it's such a neat visual experience. And I think they were paying a lot of attention to making it sticky and attractive when it came out, but just not watching closely enough, you know, every step in the process. What you were alluding to, John, is that they just reached a settlement with the FTC and have to pay an $800,000 fine for the fact that early on when the app was released, there was an ability for children under the age of 13 to sign up.
I mean, I have a problem with this. I mean, this is a big, to me, this is the issue that I have a problem with. You know, $800,000, Path's a startup. Yeah, they got a lot of VC funding, but that's just ridiculous penalty. I think it's a little bit over the top. I probably want to make an example out of them. It's not like Path is sitting there, hey, let's get 13-year-olds on board. Now, Google Plus, for example, is onboarding 13-year-olds. So I don't see them getting, you know, their hands slapped. I mean, you know, Facebook at least is a little bit harder to get on for a younger age, can actually lie about their birth date. But this is an example of where the government can really put a wet blanket on innovation. Because a lot of the stuff that's really the coolest things going on right now are things that no one's really thought of yet. So So let's take Path, for example. I mean, Path has got some data that could create a better user experience, but now they're handcuffed by essentially regulations. So that's what I worry about, is that, you know, guidelines are great, and I think that should be the guidepost. But when you start to get in and sticking the fork into people for some cash, it's really problematic. And I think that's going to slow down a lot of the innovation around mobile, because big data, as being broadly discussed, from, you know, unstructured data or semi-structured data, is actually creating a great user experience. And I think the user base doesn't know what their preferred user experience will be yet in a lot of these mobile applications. And they are situational, whether it's enterprise, consumerization of IT for a worker or an end user. So I think it's really premature to actually start whacking people for these kinds of penalties.
Yeah, it does seem like a pretty stiff penalty. For what Path did here was, there were, and this is in Path's words in its release about its settlement with the FTC, there was a period of time early in Path's history when their system did not automatically bounce people who indicated they were under the age of 13. It does now, and most systems do. Of course, you can have users who are under the age of 13, but the disclosure and consent requirements under COPPA that you have to comply with if you do that are pretty onerous. So sites just decide, nope, if you're under 13, you are not supposed to sign up for an account. Now, what are you referring to as far as Google Plus goes, John?
Well, it's an observation. So my son, I have my kids, they all have smartphones. So they got, you know, their birthday came out, or Christmas, they got iPhone 4, the hand-me-downs, you know, it's going around, right? Well, someone gets an iPhone 5, hand-me-downs the iPhone 4. So my daughter, she's in sixth grade, my son's in fifth grade, they're on Google with Gmail. Mm-hmm. And so they got Gmail accounts. So Google Plus is where they're doing their kind of collaboration with their friends, in addition to the phone. So they're not on Facebook.
Right.
So this is the new, you know, they'll find an avenue to collaborate in these virtual spaces. So,
and did they just lie about their age to get the account?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even actually know the terms of service for Google. How old you do have to be for a Gmail? I haven't really checked on where they're at, but yeah, I mean, just it's simply like there's no check.
Yeah. Okay. You're supposed to be over 13.
Yeah.
There is a check. You're supposed to put in your birthday and. You get bounced if it's...
Now, the Google police are going to come down and shut down my kids' accounts, but...
Yeah.
But they're actually using it, and they're collaborating. You know, they're doing their online, you know, interaction. Again, so it is Wild West, but they are doing it.
Yeah. And in my son's case, he's only 9, and he, too, has a Google account, but that's because their whole school is in the Google ecosystem for email and docs and all that. So his is permitted... under his school site, but they do the same thing. They all use Google Plus isn't part of it, but they chat with each other and, you know, stay very connected.
I do find it interesting to watch kind of the petri dish of experimentation, watching these kids grow up natively digital like this, and just how they're communicating and just how their social interaction is changing, and when they're in, you know, face to face with each other and also online. And we keep it. My wife Linda and I keep a pretty close eye on that.
Yeah, that's a smart thing to watch. What do you think about the Path settlement, Evan?
Well, sure, it's pretty rough. $800,000 is a lot of money, and perhaps in this instance it was overreaching. But I guess I would take a little bit of issue with what John was saying. And as much as we're declaring general principles on that, yes, it's unfortunate to see innovation slowed down. But perhaps we need to keep in mind the real interest that is at stake here, the children's privacy interest, and even more broadly, the consumer interest in having reasonable privacy protections in place. So I wouldn't be so quick to say that we should establish, and John, I don't mean to be, I certainly don't want to mischaracterize what you're saying, and I'm not necessarily saying that you said this, that all slowing down of innovation is bad. I would say that sometimes we do need to slow things down, even if it is at the price of innovation, so that we can be sure that we're being measured in the way that we're regulating these things so that all interests are at stake here. I think it's pretty easy to see that speedy innovation and release early and release often and fix bugs as they come out does often result in the payment of a price in terms of the consumer end user interest here. So as in all things, there has to be an appropriate balance and, you know, avoiding the danger of making per se sweeping rules, even if it's something as lofty and as something that we can usually all get behind of, is that innovation should move forward at the quickest speed possible in these things. If it weren't an $800,000 fine, but only an $8,000 fine, nobody would hear about it. And there wouldn't be this sentiment going out to developers and platforms and ad networks and ad exchanges and all the other stakeholders in this space that there really needs to be some care given to these types of issues.
Right. And yeah, and with fair. Mobile
I mean,
apps.
That's fair. It's the point of balance, right? It's the shot heard around the world. I mean, someone has to be a victim there, and that's FATH. My question is, who was really harmed there? But I think that's the balance, and I think we're in a good position as a society to measure things. It's not a one monolithic organization like the government's going to manage that. That's kind of what my point is. I mean, I think people should be punished, but it creates gravity around, you know, education. Fine. You know, it's just my point is I'm not a policy expert. It's just more of, you know, I want to see more experimentation, but again, not at the risk of harming, you know, large swaths of freedom and population.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
It's on the subject of PATH before we leave it. Not only, you know, there's so many moving parts when you've got a photo sharing social application like PATH. Not only do you have to take into account who's using the service and whether you're complying with all your obligations under COPPA, but as soon as you throw photos into the mix and where people are, further layers of complexity come into your privacy calculus, or they should. And I guess PATH just fixed another privacy-related problem. Of course, this was the same company that got in trouble for basically gobbling up people's address books and incorporating them into the app early on in its existence. Now it had using the embedded EXIF tag location information from photos. This was something discovered by researcher Jeffrey Paul that apparently has already been fixed and the fix submitted to Apple. This is all from O'Malik over at GigaOM. But still, you know, as privacy data in the location of your photo that is maybe counter to the settings that you've already put in, it's just another thing to have to bear in mind when you're implementing this kind of app. So that little 22-page document from the Attorney General, I think, could probably help companies avoid a lot of this stuff. I don't know if it could have helped Twitter with Vine, though, since their issue wasn't so much privacy what people
awesome.
Did.
The data guidelines thing is, I think I like this data guidelines thing because it's not putting a lot of stakes in the ground. It's essentially, you know, guideposts. And I think, you know, at SiliconANGLE, we have an analyst team at branded wikibon.org is another site. But, you know, we have a lot of research analysts as well. And we cover the big data space and storage and data protection. So we look at the data privacy thing relative to mobile from a technical standpoint. And one of the things that's not talked about publicly a lot is a lot of the advances in the technology right now is in the database side. So if you look at what Hadoop is doing, MongoDB, these are environments that are changing the game on the mobile market because you can now handle data differently than you did just 5 years ago when you had structured databases. So to change what they call schemas is a massively technical issue. And it's not always easy to do that. Now you can manage data so much more effectively, and we are so early on this movement. We're going to be at the Strata conference. SiliconANGLE TV will be doing our live cube there, and that conference really talks about a lot of this business model and policy decisions around the data. So for the first time, we can actually manage data at a flexibility and scale that can be managed. So you can say, hey, I want to share my photos just enough to get some interaction with other applications, but I don't want to reveal anything. That is really easy to do now, more easier than it was 5 years ago. So this database environment from a technical standpoint is going to change the game, and that's also affecting some of the storage business with flash memory and other technology. So these two areas of flash technology and the database on the storage side and with big data like Hadoop and this unstructured environment is accelerating what you can do with the data, the analytics, the data mining, the business intelligence. So that, I think, is going to be a big part of what will affect policy kind of formulation. And I think the goodness of what people want to accomplish around, you know, the data protection and data management.
Yeah, that's a really good point. As systems become more mature, you're going to be able to have more fine-grained controls over, you know, what users want and what the app will actually do. So that's a great thing, a great trend. So Vine, or Twitter, not so much a privacy problem here as an issue that there was stuff happening on Vine. Who would have thought, you know, new app, video only, that maybe kids under 13 should not be exposed to. So that's Twitter's own COPPA issues there, but not as far as data that they were releasing, but who could use the app. Again, you know, more along the lines of what happened with Path. So Evan, do you think Twitter's going to be fine here?
It's hard to say. I mean, I guess I would be hard pressed to see how it would look like a COPPA sort of issue. Because from what I understand with the problem with Vine, there was some human error that resulted in some content being put in front of end users that perhaps didn't want to see it or may have been too young to see it. And we all know that the FTC's powers to regulate are broad and roving and somewhat unclear. It's certainly up to its discretion to a large extent. But given that Twitter has acted so quickly to manage things here, and not only in its own infrastructure, but also in dealing with the App Store and all that stuff, and making sure that its age appropriateness is accurate, or at least the listing of it now is at least more safely assumed to be accurate. I mean, after that, it's all just looking into a crystal ball, wondering what the government is going to do to pursue someone on this. But you know, things happen, and just going back to what I said earlier, that's one of the main things of the ethos we have is, you know, release early, release often, allow bugs to be fixed in the marketplace. Here's a situation where, yes, there was a little bit of a skirmish and perhaps some things happened that aren't the most fortunate in the world. But as far as I know, it didn't result in loss of life or limb or anything like that. So hopefully we can, you know, a couple weeks from now, this will be a past history that we won't be thinking about. Maybe this is just ephemera, like so many of the things we talk about on the show.
No loss of limb, just maybe some viewing of limbs that people wished hadn't happened. John, do you think any time that something like Vine is released, it should automatically come out with a 17 plus or higher rating? Or how do you think companies should handle this?
Oh, man, it's such a hard thing to think about because I think Twitter didn't really understand what they were doing with this thing. I think it was really a rush to, on the product side, it was an embarrassment for them, obviously. But I think their intention was good. They didn't really want this to be a porn product, which it became, kind of like Chat Roulette when that came out. You know, that's where everyone kind of goes there. And I think it's just a bad product execution by Twitter. And you know, they have egg on their face and they're embarrassed because of it. But yeah, I think it begs the question, if there's any chance that it could be not suitable for kids or work, they have to kind of disclose that. But it's, again, I really can't comment on that. But my guess is that looking back, that's what they could have done. But I don't think they intended it. So I think this is just a case of bad execution on the product side for Twitter. I mean, I don't really find the product useful.
At this point, too, I'd like to let you guys know what the first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law is, and it is privacy on the go. So note that down if you are listening to the show for MCLE or other professional credit. All right. Well, Representative Zoe Lofgren has been tinkering with Aaron's Law. I want to talk about with John and Evan in just a moment here. But first, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, LegalZoom. You know, if you've been waiting for the perfect time to start your dream business, we're talking about startup companies here on the show today, it's right now. Of course, there are a lot of legal considerations that you'll want to keep in mind, but some of the real basic ones, the ones that aren't going to involve, you know, making sure that you've architected your application exactly right for the privacy standards of the California Attorney General or COPPA, if you're just interested in doing something like incorporating your business or forming an LLC, you can do that starting at just $99 with LegalZoom. Forming your business the right way can save you money on taxes and ensure that your personal assets are legally protected. LegalZoom can also help with trademarks, copyrights, patents, NDAs, and so much more. You really have to go check out their site and see everything that you're able to do there in a really straightforward way. In the past 12 years, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom for LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more. If you have a family, guess what? You need to make sure they're protected too. You can protect your family and your assets with a LegalZoom will for just $69 or establish a living trust. If you don't have a will, you leave it up to the government and the courts to decide what happens with your family and your assets, and that's never the best way to go. LegalZoom's online process guides you step by step, so it's very easy to use, and you get total customer support. If you have questions or need advice, you can even access an extensive network of attorneys through LegalZoom's legal plans available in most states. So what you do is you search an online profile and unedited customer reviews to work with a LegalZoom plan attorney who's right for you and your business. So you're not just left alone wondering if you're navigating the legal issues involved. If you sign up for one of these plans, you get a really high level of customer support from an actual attorney. And even if you don't sign up for one of the plans, and just, you know, you have some questions about what you want to accomplish on your own, LegalZoom provides great support for that kind of thing as well. So start your business and protect your family at LegalZoom.com today. LegalZoom is not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction, or you can speak to a legal plan attorney and get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. To receive a special thank you for using LegalZoom through TWIT, make sure you enter the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, in the referral box at checkout, and you'll receive $10 off. So go to LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L. Thank you so much, LegalZoom, for your support of This Week in Law. So let's look at legislation and policy right now, and specifically what might be up with Aaron's Law. Back when Aaron Swartz's suicide was splashed all over the headlines, John, you did a very compelling and heartfelt segment over at SiliconANGLE about his life and death and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and how it should change. Is Zoe Lofgren your congressman?
No.
Not quite your district. I think she's San Jose. So she has been working together with lots of folks and has a second draft of Aaron's Law that she's put up to the Reddit community to take a look at whether this would be a good amendment to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and close down some of the more concerning parts of it where you could be prosecuted for engaging in what's basically the violation of a site's terms of service. They've tried to fix some of the issues with the first draft. The most notable thing, I think, in the revisions are sort of making it in line, Evan, with the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions, if that makes sense. That in order to having accessed a site without authorization, you would have to actually circumvent a technological access barrier in order for that to trigger some kind of action under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Do you think that's a good step to take, Evan?
I think it's going too far. And I
really
think that there's going to be some pretty bad unintended consequences from that that people don't like. What it will cause to happen is the enterprise will be much more protective of its data using these technological barriers to restrict access to portions of data sets so that the enterprise can be more assured that if a rogue employee on his or her last day of work goes in and decides that he or she wants to go out with a bang and wants to delete everything that, you know, ostensibly they have access to without having to get around any kind of measure. Maybe it's in some kind of directory on the server that you don't normally go into if you don't have to do any quote unquote hacking to get there. And you delete that data without circumventing anything. The way the law reads right now, you could be prosecuted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And indeed, if that happened to my business or my company or one of my clients' businesses, I would hope that the U.S. attorney would come and put that person in jail. What will happen is that we'll see companies, in order to keep the status quo in place so that they can be protective of their information, they'll put these things in place. And that's going the side effect that nobody's going to like is that that's going to make collaboration much more difficult. It's going to be a step back in terms of all the open norms that we see developing and, you know, that we come to enjoy on the web, as sensibilities change, as they have been changing for the past several years. So I think that's a mistake to go that far on weakening the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. If anything, we should just try to rewrite the whole darn thing rather than keep patching onto it, which is just compounding the problem. There needs to be a systematic examination of the framework from the ground up rather than just continuing to build new stories on top of this when the foundation has long ago been weakened to such a point that it can't withstand any more weight really at this point.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with that. The law definitely needs some attention, and I think that maybe taking it step by step as opposed to trying to redo the whole thing is an easier way to tackle the problem, one that's more likely to actually amount to something in Washington. John, what do you think about all this?
I didn't go to law school and I'm not a lawyer. So for that reason, I don't like to get into the weeds so much, but I agree with the comment about the law being kind of the patchwork doesn't work. I think that's a big problem. I think a whole new look at it would be great. Now, I like the EFF's opinion approach on this, but a little bit, again, that's, you know, they're one side of the equation. But to me, the Aaron thing was all about proportionate punishment. And I think the education piece of what people look at as crimes, because it's a hard thing to decide in this era of data management, as we were talking earlier about privacy. There's cases, and it's all this corner cases. There's no real standard you can apply. Even on the how you call an attack, is still there's no standard there, so it's going to be very difficult. That'll be a moving train in my mind, just common sense. So my view is, you know, if it's innovative and cool, and it's not hurting anyone, you got to look at it that. But at the same time, you can't go to businesses and saying your assets in the data are unprotected because we're not going to watch out over you. So, you know, on one hand, if you're a business owner, you're like, hey, you know what? That's my data. It's valuable. And I want to protect it. I don't want to give hackers free rein to come in and under some veil of innovation take stuff. So, you know, it's really, really hard to do. So that's kind of my gut. However, the Aaron thing was one where if a group of peers got together and looked at this kind of like a jury, it would be kind of common sense. And now looking back, it's pretty obvious. We knew what MIT was doing with their work, and it was on a road to liberation on the data. And Aaron was just facilitating it in a non-malicious way, depending on how you look at it. So there needs to be some sort of process around looking at it and getting peers together. I think this is a good opportunity for the policy community to help the government with this. Because the people in the law and the government prosecuting, they don't know the difference between a white knight and a black hat. So I think that's really difficult.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Carmen Ortiz, the prosecutor responsible here, has definitely garnered her share of criticism and folks who would like to see her lose her job because of the way this was handled. Evan, do you think that they're being fair to the prosecutor and that perhaps if she'd had the kind of support that John is talking about, we wouldn't be here talking about this now?
It's hard to say. I mean, I don't have any insight really to comment on that other than to make my comments anything more than just pure speculation. But that's never stopped me before, has it? it would, I mean, if we look at this in the way you know, examining it in the terms of what we know about how prosecutors work in general, how government employees work in general, how anybody really, even lawyers as officers of the court, plaintiff's lawyers trying to prosecute a civil matter or defense lawyers trying to defend it. You know, there's never a situation where some more resources wouldn't help have a more realistic view of what's going on here. It's the U.S. attorney's job to zealously enforce the law. And, you know, the word zealous in terms of what a lawyer's obligations are is kind of confusing. It's, you know, a lawyer doesn't have an obligation to zealously represent his or her client. That's kind of an old old way of thinking about it. If you look at the rules of professional conduct, there's no such obligation there to be zealous. But that's kind of brought in as a as a societal expectation that the prosecutor will do his or her job to aggressively pursue crimes. So it's easy for a person in that position who is like the rest of us, an imperfect human, just doing his or her best job that they can, given the resources that they have, given their interpretation of their mission, of their objective in all of this. It's difficult to firmly pass judgment on someone like that. We're all just doing the best we can in this situation. And going back to what I said at kind of the beginning of those comments, all I know is that there's no situation where more resources, more information, a better, more balanced perspective of something, it's hard to find a situation where that would not be of assistance.
Yep, definitely. And I think in this case that, you know, the law too needs to be definitely closed down in the way that enabled the potential penalties that were being leveled here to be aimed at Aaron. So, you know,
if you look at the letter of the law, I mean, he was there, he did some things, but I think the proportionate punishment was out of control. And I think, you know, I think if you look at in everyone's kind of their own view, she's doing a good job. She's got a case. She wants to prosecute it to the full extent of the law. Someone was damaged in an institution at MIT. We all know kind of what that damage was really about. It was really not much. So in this case, Aaron's case, it was nothing. But there was something that happened, right, that had to be addressed. So she went full throttle to make a statement per the PATH discussion, right? Someone has to be out there and shown and you know, taken down publicly, and that's what they were doing. My issue was the failure was all across the board. When the punishment was that severe, it could not come to some common ground and say, hey, you know, do you really want to put this guy out there like that and let him hang out there to dry and get punished for that? She just took the other end of the brunt. So she took the mob attack on that side because she just was situationally there, as was Aaron. So I look at that way, and I don't think she had any malicious thing against him at all. It's just a matter of what she did. So the proportionate response was significantly relevant to her, in my opinion.
And we're also assuming that she even spent much time at all thinking about the case. I mean, she had a lot of things to think about. This was most likely, you know, 90, 95% of the brain cycles spent on this prosecution were not probably Carmen Ortiz's. Yeah. So
she's
kind of just more of a symbol of our upset reaction to all this, kind of a scapegoat's probably too inaccurate of a word, but you know what I'm saying.
So Evan, can I have you try and come up with a concrete example of if you were to adopt what Zoe Lofgren and Ron Wyden think would be a good amendment to the CFAA, and we were to make things have technological access barriers if you want to be able to criminally prosecute someone for getting at them. Do you really think that that would be that cumbersome?
I don't think it would be cumbersome to enforce. I just don't think it would give us the outcomes that we want. Perhaps I'm biased in this analysis because I come from Chicago, here in the Seventh Circuit, where we have the Citrin case, which is, and we've talked about this a lot on the show in the last few years, which that case compared with the Nosal case from the Ninth Circuit creates this split among the circuits, which is what makes it likely that this issue could get up to the Supreme Court. to ask the high court to determine when somebody has exceeded authorized access to a system. And that is a different analysis than whether somebody has just merely accessed the system without authorization. Right. In both instances, whether the question is whether you have merely accessed the system without authorization or whether you have exceeded authorized access, I think it's much too arbitrary of a line to draw if you're just going to say that everything done without having circumvented a technological measure is okay. And also everything that you do have to do by means or everything that is done after having circumvented a technological measure is does fall under the prohibitions of the statute, because there are many, you might say legion, of examples where there is real computer crime that happens without having circumvented a technological measure. And I just gave the example of the employee on his or her last day of work. That's criminal. Mm-hmm. That person should go to jail. I don't care what you say. That if somebody is going to destroy a business that way, that should be a crime. That's something that somebody should go to the federal pen for. Also, on the other side of it, there is the situation where, you know, the analogous situation in copyright law would be the people who, and I'm among the people who whine about this, that it shouldn't be a violation of Section 1201 of the DMCA to rip a DVD if I'm going to make a fair use of the copyrighted materials that's on it, without any kind of exceptions to the anti-circumvention provisions, and there are a few of these for certain filmmakers. Without those exceptions in place, it's not necessarily infringement if you rip a DVD that's copy protected and make a fair use of it, but you do risk liability under the anti-circumvention provisions, you know, Section 1201, 1202 there. So the perfect example could be in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act situation, somebody who does indeed for some good reason, maybe a security expert trying to do evaluation of the security of a system, does actually need to sometimes circumvent those technological measures to do something, that should not be a crime. And that would be much more outrageous than I would argue to prosecute someone like that, or I won't even say more so, but I would say it would at least be as egregious to prosecute somebody in those situations as what it was to prosecute Aaron Swartz in this. So I just, like I said, I don't think that it's helpful for us to draw the distinction as to what should be lawful and unlawful based on the circumvention of technological measures, because what really is at issue is the damage that is done by means of the access or of the deletion of it, rather than how they actually got to that state of being accessed, of authorized or without authorization or exceeding authorization.
I think I get what you're saying, that you need an approach that doesn't look at that single component as the touchstone for liability. And I think I agree with that. But at the same time, I like the notion of putting the onus on the person in charge of the data, whether it's, you know, a database of private user information or anything else that's living in a database that could be hacked or accessed. That if that person has not, you know, taken rudimentary steps to prevent it from being viewed by someone smart and computer savvy, then I kind of think that, you know, that they get to live with the consequences of their actions rather than putting it on the person who's been smart and computer savvy. But that's just something that...
I mean, this topic is very relevant because it crosses so many borders, right? Just policy and tech and law is one area. But if you look at what's happening in the corporate enterprises, they have the same challenges with cloud computing. And area we're covering right now is, you know, data protection inside a corporation. So, you know, the compliance and the legal issues involved around the general counsel for a big enterprise and CIO is changing. And so the CIO and the CFO and the general counsel sit there going, are we compliant? If we're an international, a multinational company, you have laws outside the U.S., another complicated issue. Meanwhile, all the developers are doing shadow IT. They go to Amazon and start programming, you know, these data models. And like we said earlier, you know, data is part of the equation. So essentially, they're opening up their entire network to hackers. you know, overlay the holistic mm-hmm. picture of what's happening recently with New York Times, Washington Post. I mean, where there's a serious war against hackers, obviously, the government is going after. So, you know, we get caught in the crossfire, the consumer side of the business, where we want to innovate. We don't want to put a wet blanket on it. So what I've been saying is I totally see the point. We have to look at this in a whole new canvas and saying, let's recast, you know, the right to bear information for users, right? What does that right mean? So I think it's a rights issue, in my opinion, and it's a huge mess right now. Huge. It's only going to get worse because of, like I said, the database technology is going to make it more pervasive to collect and ingest data. And with the tools to do data mining are going to get easier. So it's going to change a lot. So I think this is just the beginning of a major problem.
Yep. And the fact that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act can be used as such a bludgeon has definitely got to be addressed before the problem gets worse. And I'm not sure whether the solution is to toss the whole thing and start over or bolt on some appendages, but I guess maybe we'll let Congress sort that out and see what we get. But it's been fun discussing it with both of you here today. Let's talk, before we leave this topic of sort of crimes and justice here, I thought it was worth mentioning that the EFF was trying to compel the government to release upon request to people who are being prosecuted information about the government's investigation. This is in connection with the WikiLeaks case. And some activists involved there were trying to compel investigators to turn over additional orders known as 2703D orders and also pen registers that are issued at a lower standard than the usual probable cause kind of warrant. So the EFF was trying to help these folks get some information about their investigations and was relying on the First Amendment as their basis for it, saying we have a right under, I don't know, I guess sort of a journalistic right to know how information is being gathered about us. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected that and said, no, I'm sorry, it's too onerous on the investigators. They have to have some secrecy in how they go about their activities, and this crosses a line. So the EFF didn't win that one. First Amendment does not help you get at what is now currently secret information related to investigations. Evan, were you surprised about this at all?
To the extent I understood it, this was a really nuanced opinion that touched on a lot of areas of First Amendment jurisprudence and the interface with the Stored Communications Act that just kind of made my head spin and my eyes kind of gloss over after a while. So to the extent I understand it, which really is pretty well reflected in what you said there, Denise, I'm not surprised. I think that it probably has more to do with an administrative burden question than it does, or perhaps just as much to do with an administrative burden issue as what it does with the real secrecy here, because there are a lot of 2703D orders issued, I imagine. I guess we don't know for sure. That's the whole point of this case. But it would just seem like that the government would be doing that a lot based on the data we have from Google and others that talk about just how astronomically large the numbers of government requests for data are. So if there was this new right created for somebody to know what kind of information was being sought about them in connection with an investigation, or even not with a connection with an investigation, under this provision of the Stored Communications Act, that would create a huge administrative effort that would take government resources away from the prosecution of cases in a way that the court found perhaps implicitly to not be fair and not in, you know, furthering the interests that are here. Then there was this whole issue of really what it means to the integrity of an investigation, which, you know, is important. Believe it or not, the government does actually investigate crimes where there really have been crimes committed that would cause harm to us. And so, you know, there is a definite interest in making sure that investigations are done in a way that they're not compromised or slowed down or, you know, made more difficult in a way that's unfair. So I'm not surprised, I guess.
Right. And Google and other companies are trying to thread that needle pretty carefully, because on the one hand, they have to respond to government investigation requests all the time, and they're providing more and more information about how they do that, especially companies like Google and Twitter are. But at the same time, you know, they cannot just be obstreperous and not cooperate. Of course, they want crimes to be investigated. They don't want people using their services for nefarious purposes. So it's a pretty fine line to walk. But January 28th, did you guys realize that that was Data Privacy Day when it happened?
Yes.
So in honor of that, David Drummond over at Google, their chief legal officer, put out a statement on the official Google blog about exactly that, about trying to walk that line very carefully and stressing that, you know, in many, many instances, the way you might know what's going on in an investigation is because Google has provided you with that information and given you the opportunity to object or come in and try and keep the information under wraps. Evan, you think they're doing a good job on that front?
It appears so. I mean, I guess I talked about this on Twiat with Padre SJ.
Yes, you did.
A couple of weeks ago. There's also plenty of PR cred that Google can get from taking this approach. And I'm just curious about how far they would really go if challenged on, you know, the protections that they're trying to give end users here. So, yeah, good for Google.
Yeah. What do you think, John?
Well, I'd know more about it if they were doing a good job. Just they're not marketing it actively. I think it's more of a checkbox for them in my mind. Google obviously doesn't want to, you know, do too much to unveil their competitive advantage, which is data, which is the privacy issue. So, you know, Google's done a great job of beefing up their policy arm of their group, and that's been well documented. But yeah, I don't think they're doing anything bad. I think it's a good sign for Google, and they know it's a balance between oversharing. And people will go crazy if they overshare, in my opinion. So I think they're doing a good job, Google is. I don't think they're doing a great job, but I think they're doing a good job with this announcement on their privacy announcement.
All right. Good for you, Google. Let's move on and talk about some patent issues. Kaboom. This is kind of new and interesting and comes up on the patent front, but also involves some copyright overtones. And that is that Amazon has been granted a patent, I believe. It won a patent to set up a resale marketplace for ebooks. So I'm not sure if this is going to apply to any format of ebooks or just Kindle ebooks. But the idea is Amazon wants to be the place where you can basically transfer your license rights in whatever online book that you have purchased at some point. So this would be, you know, something bought in the Kindle store, or perhaps, you know, if it goes this far to the Apple eBooks platform or the Nook platform, it be able to, once you purchased it, actually resell it for, you know, a smaller cost, presumably, given the way book resales usually work. It's an interesting thing to try and wrap your head around, because it's hard to think, you know, in Amazon's case, I'm assuming that they've got to be limiting this to the Kindle, at least to start out with, because I don't know how they're going to try and manage the fact that nobody grants you the right to do this when you buy an ebook. You know, you're buying a license to use it in a limited way yourself. So Amazon, it seems to me, is breaking new ground here in the rights that people are going to have in their books by, you know, perhaps needing to retool what the terms of service are that go along with an ebook purchase, and then implementing that in a way that gives a secondary marketplace. Evan, what do you think?
I agree with everything you say. I mean, those are keen observations. The only thing I would add to that is that, you know, enterprises often obtain patents on technologies that they never use or maybe even never intend to use. And mm-hmm. So who knows, you know, what Amazon's real intentions are in all of this.
Right. And we should mention, as did TechCrunch, who reported on this today, Victoria Ho over there, that there's another service out there called Redigi that we've talked about before on the show that is in litigation with Capitol Records. And Redigi's niche is to try and help you resell things that you've purchased on iTunes Music, primarily. Although, again, I don't know if they plan to get into the books that you could also buy via iTunes. So it's an interesting notion that people want to set up secondary marketplaces in these digital goods when you get down to the fact that that's, you know, we're used to thinking about books and music that way, that they're a physical thing that you can resell in a store, but digital books function differently. John, do you think that Amazon will go through with this?
I think they will. I mean, it's one of those areas where you don't know how it's going to play out. But ultimately, if you think about the brick and mortar view of reselling and channel relationships, I think, you know, putting my business hat on, I say, okay, I have commerce going on my platform, have all kinds of coolness, recommendation engines, et cetera. Why not start exploring segmentation, the channel distribution? So the patent makes sense from a business standpoint. Again, I just don't know the workflow from a from an owner standpoint. Am I checking the right boxes? Am I giving the authorization? This comes back down to kind of the consumer terms of service. What am I signing up for? So, you know, I think in general we'll see marketplaces change in the virtual space, and you know, social networks will accelerate that. But yeah, I think it makes sense to go for it. The question is going to be on the execution, on the workflow. As an owner of an ebook, I want to know how I'm going to get paid. Distribution sounds great, but are they tracking the cash and everything else that goes on with it? So, again, some business model engineering going on with some new technical issues.
Well, it's certainly one to watch. As Evan points out, we have no idea what they will do with this patent, but they've gotten it. So maybe they're just going to troll it, Evan. Come after other marketplaces. Speaking of patent trolls, I guess our troll of the week this week, it wouldn't be a twill if we didn't have some patent troll to talk about. We've talked about this one before, and that is Personal Audio LLC, who has now sued two different podcasting entities, one being Adam Carolla's business, the other being How Stuff Works, those lawsuits filed last month. The reason I bring it up on the show, I don't have much to say about it or much light to shed. All we know is that they have, you know, aggressively gone and sued two folks now. But I am asked about this repeatedly between the shows. It's very much on people's minds. They want to hear what's going on with it. And I guess the latest that's going on with it is that EFF has asked people if they have received notices from Personal Audio LLC demanding royalties for using their podcast patent, that they get in touch with EFF. Julie Samuels over there is spearheading the effort. So definitely if you're in that boat, get in touch with EFF. So that I think EFF would like to have a good idea of who's being tapped and why. But, you know, as far as the validity of the patent goes, people recently, Dave Weiner specifically, has been trying to say that how can we possibly have a patent that was issued, you know, in 2006 or 2007 for a technology that came out in 2001 or so, that just, you know, the patent can't apply to technology that's older than it is. The clarifier there is this apparently is part of a 1996 application to the patent office and would be, you know, considered effective as of then, based on that filing. So, it's an interesting thing and of course near and dear to, everyone who is in the business of distributing audio or video, via what we think of as podcasting. When I think about this though, I know nothing about Personal Audio LLC and what their, strategy might be in pursuing these lawsuits, but I've got to think, you know, just wildly speculating that someone decided to sue because their window to do that may be closing. You know, that podcast technology is not the great economic force that it may have been, in its beginning, because the way we distribute files are, you know, has evolved and continues to evolve since that time. And I think people today are more likely to fire up an app and consume their content in a streamed way, or maybe do the downloading that way. Evan, anything to add to this whole ball of wax here?
I don't think so, other than to just, you know, say that this sounds like a really dumb lawsuit. And it's as if Julie Samuels, who has been on the show before, mm-hmm. Her new title is the Mark Cuban Chair of Stupid Patents at EFF. It's as if that position was created and named just for scenarios like this. So that's good. Yeah, it's pretty dumb.
Yep. So if you do, if you have been the subject of communication from these people, do help Julie keep track of what's going on out there. John, you and I first encountered each other at the birth of podcasting, when we were sticking microphones in each other's faces at one of Tony Perkins' events. Do you have any thoughts or concerns about this as it unfolds?
Well, podcasting is a religion. You know, it's just been so explosive from a business model standpoint. My previous company, Evan Williams's company, Adam Curry's company, the venture back guys, just was never viable. But it became such a ubiquitous standard, and it really is a great, great society benefit to everyone. So this thing is just out of control, ridiculously trolling, because the filing was filed in 2009, but there might have been some prior art. So there's a ton of prior art for this technology. So, and they're going after non-Apple. So they probably already went to Apple. Who knows if they've settled, but this is a business model that's out there. So I feel strongly that there should be some sort of, you know, test, legal test for trolls, patent trolls. You know, we all know what they look like. They're domiciling in Texas, and they're shaking everyone down, and you can just see the track record. So the cost to defend becomes the settlement. Okay, I got a choice between hiring an attorney and winning, just for the sake of winning, or just paying the ransom and the tax. And, you know, we're seeing it in Silicon Valley significantly with some these semiconductor companies. There's one company we're doing a story on right now that's out there, and won't say it yet, but shaking down everybody. And they're making millions of dollars, and it's just, you know, a patent that they found. They put it in, incorporate a new company, and they just go around knocking on the door. So it's just evil. I mean, it's just the modern of our society needs to address these things. The purpose of patents. But what was the purpose of a patent? To protect an invention. In digital, it's hard. Everything seems to have already been patented or a derivative of some other patent. So I just have a big problem with this one, because podcasting benefits everybody.
Yeah, I mean, the language here is just super broad. And if you do take it back to 1996, you know, I'm sure that it's broad enough to catch things beyond just what we think of as podcasting. So it really is a example of the problem with the patent system as a whole, that something like this could even be granted a patent when, as you say, John, there's prior art and people have been transferring files around since, you know, the dawn of the internet. So it's definitely one that's on our radar and that we're watching. I'm sorry that we don't, you know, have any silver bullets for how this is all going to wind up, but that's the way the patent system works. Unfortunately, they do have a patent on something and are out there shaking it around. So the EFF is going to help people address that problem, and would love to hear from you if you find yourself in that boat. Let us move on and talk about some things on the copyright front.
Sorry, just a second. Let me redo that. Jeff, edit this year.
All right, a little scratch in there for you today. Let us start out with the internet as a right. We've talked about this concept on the show before in the context of three strikes or six strikes programs. You know, can an ISP, a private service provider, be taking away internet access as a way to thwart somebody's alleged infringement. There was an interesting decision out of Germany recently before the German Federal Court of Justice. It was a slightly different context. His ISP basically just had a hiccup and he was erroneously disconnected from the internet. He sued over this and tried to get damages not just for his loss of internet, but also for his loss of phone and fax services. The court said, you know, faxing, what do you mean faxing? Email has overtaken that anyway. So no, you're not going to be able to get damages for that. Your phone, you had a mobile phone, so no, you weren't really harmed. But your internet access, yeah, the court got on board with that and said, we think of this as a part of your economic well-being. And if you've been deprived of it wrongfully, then and you sue for damages, then yeah, that's something that, you know, as long as you prove your case, you're going to be able to recover. Evan, do you find this problematic at all?
I don't find it problematic. I find it to be one of those kinds of cases where it was pretty insignificant legally in the broader scope of things. But for some reason, the facts are what we like to pick up on. And especially since Cory Doctorow wrote about it, whatever Cory Doctorow finds interesting, don't we all kind of presume that it's interesting, you know? So, the reason I'm kind of being a little cynical about it is, you know, what were the real damages here? The article doesn't say, and I didn't go and track down the German opinion or anything. I mean, if you're looking at a breach of contract action against your ISP for wrongfully terminating you, I'm surprised that that was not, precluded by some clause, some limitation of liability clause in the service agreement. Maybe that's a nuance of German law, or there probably would be some kind of nuance of California law or something like that if that were here. So, but okay, let's go ahead and just say it's not precluded by the service agreement. What are your damages? Well, if Comcast is going to cut off my internet service here, where do I go? I go to like WoW or something like that. Some other provider here. Maybe there's not a lot, but there's at least a couple of providers in every pretty much every place. So what? I have to pay $100 for the next month to get internet service. Okay, so the court gives me $100. So that's why I say it's probably not that big of a deal legally. It's just that there's this notion in the back of our mind, and I think it's probably more of a projection of what we wish the world were like, that there's this some fundamental human right to access the internet, as if that's going to give us a direct pipeline to God or something like that. So, it's that's my take on it. You know, big whoop.
I'm sure that some people email God in one way or another. Just like, I know they do Santa Claus, so.
Right.
It's got to be. John, what do you think about this concept of the internet as a right as opposed to a privilege or something that you're paying for?
I'm really torn on this one. I mean, I just truly believe deep in my heart that internet provides great freedom and liberation. So very libertarian on the internet access issue, and certainly higher speeds are better. So I'm just, to disclosure, I'm just totally for faster internet. Everyone should have internet. The issue of it being free is just too premature. I mean, my right is too premature in my mind, because it's kind of like, it's not there yet. I mean, it's like me trying to sue the government if I can't get to the work on the right route I wanted. You know, my car won't start. Who do I sue for that? So this comes down to a maturization of service level agreements. If I want to guarantee service for, say, my business, if I'm working at home, I should basically buy and pay for the right to have that service. And if it's damaged, the contract's broken. So to me, it's the implied contract of the internet right now is freedom, access, and that's good. Question is, I think just we have to mature that and segment out what's free and given to everybody, like a road. And if people want private roads, take the toll road. So to me, I look at it that way. It's really a basic way to look at it, but it's kind of complicated. And again, I don't know what the ISP structures are like in Germany, if they're subsidized in any way, but certainly competition should be encouraged in markets where if I got Comcast, I got AT&T, UVerse, I should have wireless overlay. So I should have a choice. And I think that ultimately is where I want to see it, higher speeds, faster. But I don't really understand where it could be the right to be sued. I just doesn't jive well with me.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on and let people know that if they were hoping to unlock their cell phone to be able to access other carriers' services, effective as of January 26th of this year, the exemption that permitted that for a while is no longer out there and available. It only ever applied to individuals. And so if you were planning to have a business, you know, unlocking cell phones and putting other services on them, you were never able to do that even under the exemption. So I don't really know that this is going to have a whole lot of impact. But if you are an individual who simply wanted to unlock your cell phone and use a different carrier, can't do that anymore. Evan, is this a bigger deal than I'm thinking or no?
No, this isn't a big deal at all, unless you just want to, you know, channel Ed Felton and figure you have some right to tinker. I don't see this having a huge economic impact. I mean, I have never had anybody tell me that they actually ever unlocked their cell phone to move from one carrier to the other. I recognize there are a few hundred people in IRC, so I'm sure that the noble majority in there will pipe up and say, of course, we do that all the time. But, you know, I'm probably not going to believe you.
Yeah, the way I keep coming up against this is, you know, businesses that have either been sued for it or should be sued for it because that's what they're doing. I like you, I'm not running into in my daily life a whole lot of people that this is going to impact. John, are you concerned about this at all?
I'm concerned about the ramifications. I do agree with Evan in one hand, but disagree with on the other, is that, you know, it's not really harming anyone. But, you know, this is an interesting thing. This was a big deal for some of my kids' friends when we were sitting around watching on the news. It was really a scary moment for anyone under the age of 20. They go, oh, my God, they are unlocking their phones. And people are looking at that as a way to have freedom and choice. And I think it's a bad precedent to say, hey, you cannot unlock them. We're going to send the government after you and put you in jail and do something bad to you because you did something that you should have the right to do. Why is that important to unlock that? And I think that's not clear to people. So I think there's a PR issue there that needs to be addressed from that standpoint. And again, I initially said, whoa, that's interesting, because I know the unlocking is a hot trend among alpha geeks and techies. But what was interesting, got my red flag up, was watching my 17-year-old son and his friends look at this and going, you know, boom. Now, they're the same guys on Pirate Bay. They're the ones who aren't paying for the music. It's a whole nother conversation. But again, right, that was a negative perception, really, really negative perception, saying, hey, who are they to tell me what I can't do with my phone? And that was interesting. I think there's a personal angle there.
I think you hit it right on, John, that it is a PR issue. There was an exemption for this that expired and was not renewed. And to answer the question of someone in IRC, yes, this relates to the DMCA. And we were talking about circumventing various technologies that are put in place to block you messing around with either a device or the data on a device. The DMCA prevents that. Unless there are exemptions granted for example, a security research or a documentary filmmaker or what have you. There are various exemptions out there that are up for renewal every 3 years. This one existed and then was not renewed. So maybe it is, you know, a question of they did not get enough good persuasive argument as to why this should exist and why these freedoms are important. And you know, again, they only ever applied to individuals. So it's not like people were asking the Copyright Office to support an exemption that would allow people to build businesses around unlocking phones. That's never been the case.
I think the way the press covered it, the way it looked at the media, I mean, it was covered on all the main channels, you know, as a featured story, as a tech story. But it was really not well explained. It was like, okay, there it is. I just think the bundling of IP services is going to be a big thing in the future. Like we have radio, frequency hopping radios for RF. I think the whole contract to your phone is going to be either bundled in or have multi-contracts built in the future. But the phone is a personal computer, and that's the way people look at it. So to me, that was the red flag. And it's just like, wait a minute, I can't do something trivial. And it's now a law. It's kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Right. All bound up with both copyright protection and communications technologies. you know, as soon as you bolt those two things onto your computing device, things start to get complicated, I guess. All right. A final copyright story for this week involves the case against AppMino by Tetris, which they won on summary judgment last May. They just had a final judgment entered in their favor. The Tetris company won this against a copycat Tetris-like game maker and did a press release this week that got it in the headlines. This case was really resolved last year. Evan, why are we just getting a judgment entered on this now? Do you have any idea? What have the parties been up to here?
No, I didn't know. I thought this was already... already decided by the court, and there was this article about it, and there was like a news release or something about it. And
They just entered judgment last week, but the summary judgment was last May.
That might just be I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, I'm sure we could figure it out. I just didn't take the time to go look to see what it is. You know, of course, the courts are always explicable, right, in what they do. So we should also be kind of nice in talking about this because, you know, your and my mutual friend Joe Gratz, you know, his law firm represented the Tetris's opponent in this. So, you know, let's be nice. Oh, what an outrage, right? You know, Joe should have won. So.
Well, it's a complicated case, and there's a really good article at Public Knowledge about all the various nuances of this and what parts of games are copyrightable. That was written by Michael Weinberg, who's been on the show over at the Public Knowledge site. I'll go ahead and put it. It's in the show notes for episode 171 when we first talked about this case, but I'll put it in this week's discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/197. So you can look at it there, too. It really kind of goes through all the various ramifications. But Tetris has prevailed on this one. Before we go on, I want to talk to, with John before we let him go about taking companies private and what Dell is up to. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. You know, in business, effective communication is everything. You have to send email with attachments all the time. And guess what? If they're too big, they bounce back. You're unhappy, your recipient hasn't gotten the email, your recipient is unhappy, they're sitting there waiting for whatever it is you've promised that you're going to get them. It wastes everyone's time and energy. And dropping your files into online boxes for others to access, that's not safe or secure either. But ShareFile by Citrix understood these challenges and created a better solution for business. Now millions of accountants, lawyers, and other business professionals rely on ShareFile. ShareFile is so easy, it's for anyone to use. It allows you to send files of almost any size securely. You can track the progress of your files. You get notifications automatically. They're sent as soon as the file is opened. You can control who has access by using tools like password protection. And you can even sign and edit files for streamlined collaboration. So aside from the security overtones, which of course you need to make sure are in place, you can use this as a very nice both remote access tool for your data and also an online collaboration tool. You can access your files from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone. So I really want you to try it. I have a special offer for you so you can try ShareFile for free. Sign up for a 30-day free trial today with no credit card required and nothing to lose. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone, enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. And here we'll go ahead and let you know what the second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law is. It is going private. So if you need more information about listening to This Week in Law for mandatory continuing legal education credit or credit in your other profession, head on over to the TWIT Wiki and there is lots of information there for you. So one of my most favorite classes in law school, John, was securities law, about companies trying to get their stock out to the public and get public participation. And what people don't think about so much is that after you've been a public company so long, circumstances might come around that cause you to say, you know what? We're going to take this puppy private again. And that's what Dell is trying to do. And you think this is a great move. Why is that?
Well, like you, when I was in business school, I studied entrepreneurship and finance was my degree, dual degrees. And I was always fascinated by financial strategy. And one of the things that I observed was, you know, being flexible and managing the marketplace is really the key to success for most businesses. And Dell is such a successful company that their success has grown to the point where, you know, they're so public and so big, it's hard to actually move when the market's moving so fast. So to me, I think Michael Dell's move to go public represents a lot of the what might be written about in case studies in the future as a really a good, bold move, or it's going to sink the ship. We'll see. But I think it's a good move for a couple of reasons. One is Dell really is positioned well for the long term of the enterprise market and consumer market, possibly. They pioneered a business model that is well known and documented, the direct business model, mail order, computers, and then ultimately, you know, challenging and beating HP and IBM and others, Compaq in the personal computer business. But that has changed with cloud, mobile, and social kind of driving this transformation. You know, Dell is not positioned in a couple key areas. One is they don't really have a mobile presence, and their PC business is based on Windows. And, you know, the Wintel monopoly that drove the computer industry is over. You know, even though Windows 8 is a new operating system, it just doesn't have the muscle that Windows had in the old days. And Windows had no competition. Apple wasn't really competitive to that monopoly. So you really, betting everything on Windows is a challenge. So I think going private is one that will allow the company to kind of step out of the public's eye in terms of the classic reporting and the, you know, the, all the requirements to comply with being a public company, disclosure, all the data sharing to all the shareholders. You know, that's a requirement that, one, burns up a lot of resource, and two, exposes to the capital markets, hence the public market, your moves and your business. Being private, you don't have that obligation as to the level of being a public company. So this allows them to get back into a shell and to retool or pivot, as they say in the industry. And they need to do that. And it's going to involve economics, how they subsidize the edge of the network, whether it's PCs, handhelds, or tablets, how they handle some of the enterprise customers that they have with data centers. And so much is going on there, and allows them to essentially reset probably some of the financial strategies and how they report gross margin, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, it's a risky move, but because he's the founder and his name is on the door, this is very much a Steve Jobs-like moment for Michael Dell, especially mm-hmm. under the light of how much criticism he got when he mentioned about Apple prior to Steve Jobs joining, that he should just give the money back to shareholders, and Apple then went on a run, a historic run that they're on now. So interesting scenario at many levels for the press and also the company. But I think it's a good move because it allows them to retool faster. And that nimbleness could turn them from an aircraft carrier to a battleship if they do it properly. So that's kind of the high level simplified version of my analysis.
Yeah, I think it's a really intriguing thing to do with a company like Dell that, you know, as you point out, has such an established business and that's gone along, you know, in kind of a rut for a while now. And there's so much opportunity that it could jump onto with the whole concept of, you know, what I think of when I think of Dell is the ability to customize something exactly how I want it. And whether that's a computer or a tablet or a phone, you know, I think there's so much they could do with that that they haven't been able to because of their business model and the way that they've been answerable to shareholders.
Some of the IRC people saying what they're going to build. So be specific. I would say that, you know, a couple of things. Microsoft might own this one comment that was funny. Mm-hmm. Microsoft's a big player in this, but here's the thing. Windows 8 is not a done deal. Microsoft's got their own Surface out there. You know, Apple's changed the game on how people are going to build in the components. But if Dell wants to be a serious player in the enterprise and consumer, they got to have a phone. They mm-hmm. have to have a tablet. And I've been critical of HP not to sell their PC division because, you know, if you want to be a player, you got to have that device. Now everyone's going to say, yeah, they have no chance. I remember when Dell had the initial mail order PC. I remember when they had no notebook. They hired mm-hmm. a guy from Apple, and then the guy who did the PowerBook. They dominated that market. They went on a nice run. So Dell has the chops to compete. And so that's the factor. And they have to have a phone. Has to be global. They have to have a tablet, and they have to have the new devices. They have the back end going on. They're really weak in storage, but outside of that, solid business relationships with the enterprise customers. And again, they have the supply chain and the build-to-order scale to do a phone and do it well. So that's really the big challenge there on that side. And then handling the Windows 8 hedge will be something important. If they go Windows 8, Microsoft's obviously putting a lot of dough in. They want to try to compete and make that a full-on environment end-to-end, kind of like the way the iPhone is. So that's kind of one area I think that they might do something compelling.
So just to mention, there was another company I saw in the headlines that I've seen over the last few years. About.me was bought by AOL. It's also going to take itself private and buy itself back from AOL. Evan, do you have any thoughts about the strategy of doing this?
I leave it up to the financial experts and the smart corporate transaction types. So, yeah, I mean, it the thing that's most interesting in the Dell situation is the shift from emphasis in hardware to software. So I see that interesting as a sociological and cultural phenomenon, and a phenomenon that pertains to the development of technology and all of that stuff. But, don't look to me to say anything brilliant about financial strategy or anything like that on this.
And can I look to you to say anything about the shareholders? You know, what happens to people who own Dell stock at this point?
I couldn't say anything about that either. I mean, there certainly would be expectations that are in play there, but I would just have to talk to somebody smarter when it comes to those issues.
All righty. There is a good MSN Money story on this. Michael Foulkes, if I'm saying his name correctly, has some thoughts about the stock and what to do if you own the stock. Apparently the buyout price is going to be very close to what it's trading at now. So no real reason to do anything, it kind of sounds like. John, do you agree with that?
Agree with what? Them buying the stock back? Or
No. For people who right now hold shares of Dell stock, would you think that they'd want to hang on to the stock or sell the stock? Seems like they would.
I think they're being forced to sell from what I was seeing. And I think they should be given the option to hold. But I'm not the securities guru, so I'm not sure how you want to parse the deal. I mean, it wasn't really a tender offer. Was it a tender offer? Was it buyback?
Characterized here as a leveraged buyout.
Leveraged buyout. So that's a forced sale, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think employees I talk to at Dell who privately tell me that they're really not happy about it. So I know that the sentiment inside Dell, there's really two camps. There's the let's turn this puppy around, let's win. And then they got a management team that's, again, refreshed. Dell's taking over, and he's taking over the helm, and he's brought in his own guys. Marius Haas came from HP. He was at KKR, so we left HP. He went to KKR, so we know what they're great at LBOs. He also did the deal with 3Com when he was at HP. So Dell brought in and has a new crew at the top that he's grooming. And yeah, they have a great services business that they're expanding, and they're doing really well in the enterprise. They're positioned beautifully in the enterprise, and that's not being valued by Wall Street. So, again, that's more of the analysis. But, yeah, I think you're a shareholder. You got to be bummed if you're an employee. You want some of that stock. Now, I don't know what they're going to do on the private side, if they're going to issue ESOPs or whatever they're going to do. So we'll see.
We will. And good luck to Michael Dell, and hope that they can do some fun and innovative stuff as a startup company once again. Let's go on to our tip of the week. This is something that I spotted over from Mike Masnick's coverage of this on TechDirt, and it's something that makes really good sense. I think it makes a perfect tip of the week. The reason this came to my attention is because of a librarian named Bobby Newman, who uses Creative Commons photos on Flickr for presentations and in her blog. So she's very careful to make sure that she's licensed for the use that she wants to put the photo to. But the kind of loophole here is that Flickr makes it very easy to find Creative Commons photos, but it makes it very easy for that license to change too on the rights holder's side. And if it's changed after you've already used it, it's really hard to go back and tell the rights holder, well, hey, when I downloaded this photo and used it, it was licensed for this use. If someone ever comes back after you and says, no, that license doesn't apply, you need to have proof of what the license was. So our tip is, if you're using Creative Commons material of any kind, log the license when you use it. Keep a record of it. I don't care if you do a screen cap and just keep a little file to show that this was the license in effect. You know, you can swear to that if you ever need to. There's also a business around this, of course. Whenever there's some kind of problem to be solved, some entrepreneurial person is going to try and solve it. I don't know if this is meant to make money, this business, but it is called Image Stamper, and it does exactly what I just said. It basically takes a screen cap of the license at the time you want to use it. It puts a timestamp on it so that, you know, you have a verified third party keeping track of this, and it also stores everything on its end, so you don't have to worry about keeping track of that yourself. So I think Image Stamper is a good solution to this. Of course, you can accomplish the same simply by keeping records on your end of whatever Creative Commons material that you used. Evan, this wasn't something I'd given a lot of thought to before, but I think it's a really good idea. Do you agree?
It is a good idea, and to the extent the record-keeping process can be made easier, that's a good thing. I've had some issues in clients of mine who have wished to use Creative Commons works before, and then helping those clients do a little bit of diligence on it. We came to the conclusion that on Flickr especially, there is a ton of content that purports to be licensed under Creative Commons, but you can just tell that person who posted right. it to their account doesn't own the copyright in the first place. So that seems to be another species of danger when it comes to all this stuff. So whatever you can do to keep good records and demonstrate your good faith is a good thing. But you know, there probably will always be perils of using Creative Commons. Not that that should slow someone down all that much.
Yes.
On it.
The corollary tip should be, if it's a picture of Mickey Mouse, then perhaps think twice about whether that person actually had the license to put it up.
Right.
All right. For our resources of the week, I have a couple. Number one is an article over at Daily Kos and a petition that the article is discussing to put as a candidate for federal communications chair Susan Crawford in front of the White House. So the White House petition is sadly only sporting 708 signatures at this point. It needs 99,292 more to go to reach its goal by February 23rd. So get out there and sign this petition if you're so inclined. Susan Crawford is a wonderful professor and thinker about all things related to FCC issues, and would be a darn fine FCC chairman, in my own personal opinion. If you want to read more about her, you can go to the Daily Kos article, and there's a lot of background on her, also some at the petition itself. So definitely check that out. Would be great to get her on the administration's radar for that post opening up. And then our other resource of the week is just something leisurely for you to sit back and enjoy, especially if you enjoy the Swedish language, because there is a documentary about the Pirate Bay called TPB-AFK, which stands for the Pirate Bay Away From Keyboard, that is an hour and a half long documentary about the Pirate Bay and its founders. It's in Swedish with English subtitles. It's free on YouTube and, of course, also available on the Pirate Bay for download. I haven't watched it yet, but someone in chat was saying that they had. And certainly with over at TechCrunch, they say it looks like a great way of avoiding the coming snowpocalypse. So as we hunker down for a snowy or cold weekend across the United States or wherever you may be in the world, it seems like a nice way to spend your time. Evan, it sort of reminds me of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I first saw in Swedish with American subtitles, hopefully less bloody.
Right. Well, who knows? Bloody in some sense. You know, there's some interesting things going on. Yeah, I haven't looked at this, but this does look like something good to watch. I think I will.
Great. All right, so now that we've taken care of your weekend's entertainment, we'll go ahead and thank John Furrier so much for joining us today. It's great to catch up with you, John.
Yeah, great here. Great for having being on the show. Appreciate it, and great to see you.
I've been following you on SiliconANGLE since it came online, which was fairly recently now. Tell us what's going on with that and what your goals are for the project.
So SiliconANGLE is we call the reference point for tech innovation. We were the first tech blog in the industry to cover the notion of cloud, mobile, and social. And our tagline is where computer science meets social science. So we really are looking at the confluence of, you know, the social change that's going on in our society, driven by the computer science trends, the technology, and some of the disruptions. So we've been doing that. We have a research analyst piece of our business called wikibon.org, and we do free research. So we are all about free content. All the content is completely free, and our goal is to have as highest quality content as possible with a journalistic independent view, as well as research analyst content that's free, no paywalls, and no banner ads. So the site is completely banner free. And we have a web TV operation that we do at events called The Cube. And we go out to a lot of the enterprise areas that we're covering in the cloud, mobile, and social area and cover that. And our two main kind of focus areas within that is we call software-led infrastructure or software-defined infrastructure and big data. It's the big areas that we're digging deep in. And we've been a lot of success and got a great business model around using our data. We're a very data-driven media company. So we've had great success. I think we're like at 29 people now in the company, cash flow positive, growing, and having a great time. So Mark Hopkins, ex-Mashable, Kristen Nicole, ex-Mashable, are also on the team from way back when. And we have a variety of folks at Wikibon led by my partner, Dave Vellante. So it's been great. We're doing great, having fun and expanding and hiring. So, you know, this year we're going to do a lot more video. Last year we did 27 events. This year we should do about 40 live events where we cover in depth all day live streaming. So should have a lot of fun.
That's great. Well, it's good stuff over there, and we're really thrilled that it's going great for you, John, and so excited that you were able to join us today. Great insights and thoughts for us all.
Great. Thanks.
And Evan, it's wonderful, as always, to end my week with a great chat with you.
Hey, thank you. I enjoyed it as well. And John, really enjoyed talking with you. Great to learn more about what you're doing, the stuff you're thinking about and writing about and talking about. So I really enjoyed our conversation as well.
And let's do it again.
Right on.
All right, guys. Well, I just want to let people know that they can catch this show every Friday at 11 Pacific time, 1900 UTC, when we record it live on the TWiT network. If you can't do that, you can find us on iTunes and on YouTube, and our show page is at twit.tv/twill. So you'll find all our shows going back to the cooling of the earth right there on that page. You can also find us between the shows on Facebook. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. We have a Google Plus page over on that platform. And I am generally tweeting and putting stuff up on the social networks about what we're going to talk about on the show. So love for you to converge with us in those spots and let us know what's on your mind, what you'd like us to see cover, what you'd like to see covered here on This Week in Law when we come back again next week. I think we're going to try and do back-to-back shows on the 15th. So if you're looking for a double dose of Twill, next week would be the time to join us. Anything else you can think of, Evan, before we sign off?
No, just have a great weekend. And, you know, just if you're going to do any reading Shakespeare, this would be a good weekend to read Richard III, I guess, you know, catching up on the big news with him being found under the parking lot.
I think that's a fine idea. Well, I'll watch Swedish subtitled YouTube films and read Richard III and be well taken care of for the snowpocalypse.
There you go.
Yes, we're having a rain apocalypse outside right now, which means it's lightly sprinkling in Southern California. So for anyone else who is facing more severe weather, we wish you all the best. Stay warm and safe, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.